This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today our show is going to begin with a discussion about a new documentary that's out there about a North Dakota town that no longer exists. It's under Lake Sakakawea. That's Elbow Woods, North Dakota. And joining me to talk about this new documentary are two people who were intimately involved in the production. Matt Olean, of course, from Prairie Public. He's the producer and the writer. He also does some narration on it. Matt, always a pleasure to have you on our air.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
And Merrill Pepcorn, a familiar voice to Prairie Public listeners, former host of This Hour in the Day, now a state senator and an entertainer of note. And Merrill, you're assistant producer and narrator on this show, and this is an idea you've been pursuing for a while, right?
Well, it is. And thanks, Doug. It's good to be here in this particular chair of Main Street as well, as opposed to the chair you're sitting in here now. Appreciate the work you've been doing.
Well, let's talk about what Elbow Woods is. Why did you want to tell this story?
I first discovered the story of Elbow Woods, and I love the way the residents of Elbow Woods pronounce the name of the town. It's not Elbow Woods, it's Elbow Woods. And we're just going to make it a point of pronouncing it like that because it's fun to say. But I first became aware of the story of the 1942 Elbow Woods basketball team by way of a newspaper article that tribal historian, and she was the head of the Three Affiliated Tribes Museum for many, many years, Marilyn Hudson. She wrote an article that appeared in some newspapers, I'm not even sure which ones, about 20 years ago. Now, I came across it when I was pursuing an ill-fated attempt at a master's degree at NDSU. But KDSU was then not part of the Prairie Public system, and so I know it was 19, 20 years ago that I came across the story. It was a wonderful newspaper account of this team. So similar to the interviews that you do now, Doug, I called up Marilyn. We did an interview about this wonderful story of this great team that, you know, eventually wound up with this championship from that year. And I said to her at the time, and she agreed, I said, Marilyn, this is a great story. It's got to have a bigger audience than just your newspaper article and our little interview here. And she agreed, and we made several attempts at it, and finally it is done, and we'll be premiering soon on Prairie Public Television.
Well, as a matter of fact, the audio version of this story will premiere Sunday at 5 on Prairie Public Presents. That's 5 Central. And the TV show will be at 8 o'clock Central on Monday, the following Monday. And the name of the documentary is Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbow Woods. And I think, Matt, you're strongly interested in Class B basketball.
Yeah, I did a documentary some years ago on the history of the State B, and that ties into this as well. So it was about a year ago, I think, Merrill, that we all went out to Newtown to meet with Chairman Mark Fox, the chair of the Three Affiliated Tribes, and kind of brainstormed who needs to be interviewed for this story, what kind of video we need, that kind of thing. And Mark and I connected immediately because he went to college with a friend of mine from Oaks, Bob Baldwin, and Mark was 2 grades ahead of me. He would have been graduated from Partial in 80, and I was Oaks 82. And we went to a lot of State B tournaments, and I have all the programs in my office. And as Mark noted, when you would open up those old State B programs, and Merrill knows this, you would see all the list of the title games. And in 1942, it always said no championship. And I always wondered what that meant. Is it World War II? Why was there no championship? And as Merrill found out through this story, the reason there was no championship was because of a dispute that happened in the championship game. That I don't know if we want to give that away, Merrill, because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, maybe we should hold on to that.
We should hold on to that piece of information, a bizarre twist when they played Lakota in the championship game. And there were actually 2 twists that happened with this, which what happened in the championship game, involving ineligible players. So that's where the genesis of this happens. So what the documentary does, Doug, it traces the season, the 42 season. Then there's a middle section that talks about the Garrison Dam, which was constructed in 1953 and ended up in flooding out Elbow Woods. And the final section of the documentary focuses on the Elbow Woods people's efforts to right this wrong and have the words no championship removed from the State B programs and to finally recognize the legitimate champion of that season.
So Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbow Woods is the name of the documentary. And you've mentioned a name that we're about to hear here. This is Marilyn Hudson. She is the historian for the three affiliated tribes and, interestingly enough, was a graduate of the last class of Elba Woods in 1953.
Good.
So she's going to describe the town for us, and then Byron Dorgan, who has an interest in this particular part of the state as well, will describe his experiences visiting it.
The town was named Elba Woods, which makes a lot of sense. It's a very visual thing, an elbow in the woods. And the Missouri River in that location flowed southward from like what's now Williston. So the Missouri River was flowing southward, and then it makes that bend and goes eastward. And in that bend of the river then is where the community of Elba Woods was established. The population probably would have been maybe 200. Well, the town of Elba Woods really, I think the best classification would be an Indian agency was there, and that was sort of the hub. But it was not incorporated as such in that we did not have a mayor or a city council or anything like that. It was totally a government.
My father lost his parents at a very, very early age, and as a young boy, he, among other things, herded horses on the reservation. He went up to the Indian reservation and got a job, and from that he loved horses all of his life. But in the process of doing that, later in life, he said to me, "I want to take you back up to see the friends I have on the Indian reservation." And we drove to the Fort Berthold reservation, and we drove into Elba Woods, North Dakota. And I have memories of it as a young boy driving into this little town about the same size as my hometown of Regent, North Dakota, several hundred people. It was quiet, pretty little community.
That's former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan.
You know, Doug, I'm originally from Stanley, North Dakota, which is about 30 miles north of Newtown, which is a few miles north of where Elba Woods used to sit, now, of course, under Lake Sakakawea. And I was too young to remember the building of the Garrison Dam and the flooding of that area when I was a little kid, but we did move to Fargo shortly thereafter. But I know people. I go to church in Fargo with some people who grew up in the Minot area there, and they remember driving down into Elba Woods as young kids and just driving around and seeing the scenery and everything. So it's very much a part of the history and lore of the people of that area, and it was really fun to learn more about it.
And Matt, basketball was a big deal in Elba Woods.
Yes, a huge deal with the tribal culture. Basketball is very important. They had a really good team that year. The coach of the team, Leon Wall, is an interesting person. We actually have film footage in the TV documentary of Leon Wall in Elba Woods, and we have someone narrating his memoirs about those years. So he comes into this town from Oklahoma, and it's kind of an agency town, right, Merrill? That's what they refer to Elba Woods as, an agency town on the reservation. And he was really an employee of that whole federal Indian agency thing as the coach. And he quickly realized these kids had talent, and he was going to mold them into hopefully a championship team.
And first of all, Doug, you know that Leon Wall came to Elba Woods as a teacher. He had mm-hmm. five or six classes, including science classes and math classes, that he was there to teach. He didn't find out he was going to be coaching this basketball team until he got there. Yeah, but he was ready for it and, you know, took them to the championship game.
Well, they seem to be gifted as players. A lot of the documentary, I had a chance to listen to it. They talk about their speed and their ball handling, Matt.
Yeah, so that's what Mark Fox talks about, is that they were a little bit ahead of their time with their ball handling and their speed. And Dale Brown talks about watching Elba Woods teams of those years, and his quote is they could run forever. And Elba Woods had good teams all the way through the early 50s. I think they went to state six times before the town was dissolved. And what you'll see in the TV documentary too, Doug, is we got some kids who go to Newtown High School now that are runners and athletes to come and do some recreations for us at the old gym in Makoti. And so you'll see kind of black and white slow motion stuff of these kids, and each of the kid plays a specific player on the team, and uh-huh. we credit them at the end. You know, Jariah Pretenzeagle and Jordan LeBeau and some of these kids, they actually portray some of the players: Johnny Rabbithead, Isaac Fox, Sidney Fox. So they actually got to be actors.
Uh-huh.
I will say, Doug, you know, that standard basketball in that day in the 1940s wasn't like Elbowoods played then that year. And it started a whole new trend in basketball. And we still see it today, the run and gun ball. And, you know, everybody's always excited when a native team makes that Class B tournament. Usually there's one and often two because they do run and gun and shoot. But it was interesting. So it was mainly, you know, you'd get a rebound or somebody make a ball, you'd bring it down court, you'd get into the half court and, you know, make a couple of two-hand chest passes and stay in your place, and then somebody would eventually put up a two-hand shot. But Leon Wall saw something in these young fellows, saw their athletic ability and their enthusiasm. They were a good bunch of kids, got along well with the coach, this new young guy who came up to teach and coach, and he kind of let them loose and kind of cultivated that free spirit and let them do their thing out there.
Well, we have another clip to play here, and this one features Mark Fox, the chairman of the three affiliated tribes, whose dad was on the team.
His dad, Isaac, and his uncle, Sidney, was on the team as well.
Wow. And Dale Brown, who's raised in Minot, went on to be a big-time college basketball coach, and Mike Jacobs, who's the former publisher and editor of the Grand Forks Herald, who grew up near Elbowood. So let's listen to this segment.
The name that was given to them was Dazzling Indian Quint. The media started calling this Dazzling Indian Quint because they're dazzling, they're Indian, and there's five on the floor, and they're doing some amazing things. You combine that with a small gymnasium where a radiator sticks out on the floor. You know, it's just a fast evolution of basketball for Elba Woods.
They had inferior equipment. They were not equipped in the football or basketball or anything like the rest of the schools, particularly the sneakers. Tattered sneakers, but they won. I remember the one guy passed like he's going to be a softball. He'd go behind his back and then left-hand it. They loved the game. They were flashy. And they were the Harlem Globetrotters kind of, but I never, there was a sharing of the ball, and I think that came from that tribal culture. You're talking about the sportsmanship. They follow somebody, they'd raise a hand, they'd pick up somebody from the floor.
Almost every Sunday in summer after the dam was closed, we would drive down half an hour drive, maybe a little bit more, to watch the water come up in places that he remembered. When the water got to Elbow Woods, it was a place that he very much wanted to see and to remember. He'd spent time there as a boy and as a young man and really even as an adult and the father of my older siblings. So we would drive down most Sunday afternoons and essentially watch the water creep into the town. It took almost a year before the water actually got to Elbow Woods. And then it didn't rise all of a sudden. It wasn't, you know, it was a slow flood. So you could live comfortably in the town while there was water coming up in the streets and the low places. And so people didn't leave until they had to. And I think there was a sense that what they were going to was nowhere nearly as good as what Elba Woods was.
That was Tribal Chairman Mark Fox, followed by University Basketball Coach of note, Dale Brown, and Mike Jacobs, who grew up near Elbowood. And we're talking about Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbowoods, which is the documentary that will air on our television service at 8 p.m. on Monday. And then there will be a radio version of this the day before on Prairie Public Presents at 5 p.m. Central. This documentary tells an interesting story in an interesting way, and because it talks about a town that's no longer there, Matt. It's underwater, under Lake Sakakawea, that had a legacy that they're very proud of, but something happened, interrupted it in 1942.
Yes, World War II interrupted everything, but they played the season, of course. They played the season. That's not why there wasn't a no championship thing. And I want to mention, too, we interviewed children of the players. None of the players are alive still. Harold Olderman was the most recent to pass away in 2015, but most of the children are interviewed in this documentary. I want to give a shout-out to Merrill, too. This was kind of Merrill's idea from the start to do this, and then he kind of came to me and Bob Damback about it, and we kind of took it from there. But this wouldn't have happened without Merrill's close association with the tribes, with Mark Fox, with Steve Martins up in Lakota, who's an interesting guy that people will see in the documentary as well.
Well, I was interested in listening to the documentary because there's a lot of detail about the kind of place they played in, the gym they played in, Merrill, yeah, with a radiator in the middle of the court.
Yeah, it was very, very small gym. As a matter of fact, Leon Wall, when he made a couple of comments about it, said that the Elba Woods gym is so small that the free throw circle intersects with the retaining circle at the center of the court. So that's small. But also, of course, there's the famous Johnny Rabbit Head radiator shot where Johnny Rabbit Head, the gym was so small, the radiator that heated the gym actually stood out on the floor, the actual playing surface. And so it was part of the gym, part of the floor. And so Johnny Rabbit Head would get the ball, he'd dribble down, he'd leap up on the radiator and then propel himself towards the basket and shoot the ball. It was a little too far away to dunk, but he would just kiss it softly off the backboard and in. So these days, with all the propensity for nicknames, he'd be Johnny Radiator Rabbit Head, of course.
And we have one of the boys recreate that shot. We didn't bring a radiator in, but we did have him. I coached him on how to possibly do this shot, and he made it several times.
And that gym that you were just describing, Merrill, with a radiator in the middle of it, also could seat people just literally up to the boundary of the court, like one row of chairs on each side,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, maybe 3 feet between the out-of-bounds line, sideline, and the wall. And, you know, early on in those last sound clips, we heard about how people just appreciated and heaped praise on this team. And I want to read one short clip. I think it's probably from the Washburn newspaper about this team that a sports writer wrote. You know the flowery language. And this writer wrote, "Did you notice," he's talking about the team, "did you notice how they fairly shine? The way Charlie Blake smiles when they call a foul on him. The way Isaac Fox agreed with the referee when they called a close one on him. The way the entire team was ready to help an opponent who fell down."
Yeah.
You know, so they were just held in high regard. They were respected. They put on a show, and their legacy lives on to this day.
And that legacy was put underwater in a fair, yeah. You know, by the creation of the Pixlohn Dam system, mm-hmm. which Garrison Dam was an important piece of. That was built. It was an engineering marvel at his time, Matt, but it meant that water was backed up behind it and Elba Woods went underwater. And Mike Jacobs described the slow process of that as people were looking at their town getting erased.
Dorgan describes Pixlohn in the documentary as big thinkers with big ideas. It was this massive main stem dam plan all through the Midwest and down through the plains to basically control flooding. And Mike Jacobs notes, if that was proposed today, it would never, ever get passed.
Yeah.
But because Garrison Diversion was never finished, that's partly why it would never get proposed today, because part of it worked theoretically. It did control flooding, but the cost to the Native Americans was enormous, and they had to move up to Newtown and Partial and places like that.
Well, they flooded some very fertile land as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, Doug, because of my experience now in the state Senate, I deal with Indian gaming and taxation issues and spending of oil revenues and the sharing of these revenues and such. And it's given me a modern insight into this 50, 70, 80-year-old dilemma of having your town flooded. And they're still struggling with that stress, that anxiety of being displaced and into this new town. But
Which is the name of the
town. Newtown,
yes.
The Newtown. And I often drive south on 1804 out of Bismarck down to towards Linton. And there Lake Oahe from South Dakota starts backing up. And you get a sense of the millions and millions of acres that were flooded by this project that Matt just talked about, this massive project of dams up and down the Missouri. And you realize that, yes, this, you know, these days we talk about takings, the taking of land, the taking of mineral rights, poor space, whatever it might be. Well, this definitely was a taking of millions of acres, and it gave me a new understanding on how difficult that would be for a culture to absorb and kind of move on from. And, they're trying. It's a never-ending struggle to do that.
Well, the documentary is Basketball, Water, and the Lost City of Elbow Woods. And 1942 is an important year in the history of that now lost town. because there was a basketball championship that year, and something happened, and we won't go into the detail. We'll keep the punchline for the documentary. But we are going to hear one more segment here, and this is Dale Brown again, who was raised in Minot, became a famous college basketball coach, and Donna Taken Alive. She was a daughter of one of the players, and talking about the legacy of the town going away and how it still affects the three affiliated tribes.
It was not as pronounced to me then as after I met people in the Indian community from there later on in life. And here are the pain and the anguish and the fear and how the con job they got, what they were supposed to get, they didn't get. I remember driving when the water was coming up. I can remember seeing that and thought, where are they going to go? What are they going to do? How are they going to be in tent cities or what? And how would we feel if all of a sudden they're coming in and flooding our homes? And as you mentioned, the project's never finished. How many millions or billions did that cost?
Our family had pigs, they had livestock, they had chickens. And one way we found out of when they moved, the allotment movement, we have a receipt of everything that was moved of our grandparents, and the government paid them to move. So when our dad went to college in 1950-51 and played football, he came back to help the move. And when you think about that and all those young athletes, when they played at Alba Woods, it was a dynasty for basketball. And they went to the state tournament, I believe, 6 times out of the 17 years they were there. And then they get drafted and they go off to war and they come back. And they come back to where their land is being taken away, their homes are being taken away, their livelihood is being taken from them. And it must have been a feeling of betrayal.
That's pretty evocative, Matt. And the music, we should mention about the background music we're hearing, too.
Yeah, we used a lot of music. We used a lot of Keith Bear music, too.
Mm-hmm. The flute.
There's a lot of flute music. That's not Keith right there, but Keith Bear's CDs helped us a lot with giving kind of a mood to the story. Donna was a great interview. Her dad was not a starter on the team. He was a younger player on the team, but there were a lot of charging kids through the years in Elba Woods. I know Dale Brown talks about his brother Arnie, who was a great athlete, but lots of discussion, too, about how towns were lost. We have actual film footage of houses being moved away from Elba Woods that we discovered.
And, Merrill, this documentary is going to be shown to the descendants of Elba Woods?
Yes, and Matt knows the details, but it's Monday night, May 20th. Happens to be my birthday, by the way, but it's going to be a big, other than it being my birthday, it's going to be shown in Newtown, and that'll be a great community event up there.
That's at the Four Bears Casino in the Grand Ballroom, 7 p.m. Monday night, open to the public. We're going to be up there, myself, John Harris, Bob Dambach, Barb Gravel, and a lot of members of the three affiliated tribes will be there to watch the premiere.
That's the television service of Prairie Public Monday at 8 Central, and you can hear the documentary in an audio version for radio Sunday at 5 on Prairie Public Presents. Merrill Pepcorn, always a pleasure to have you in.
Just great to be here talking about this great film. I hope it has a long life and a lot of the young people on the reservation get a chance to see it, and it will inspire them to live great lives and, you know, carry on this legacy.
And Matt Olean, thank you as well.
You bet.
Well, coming up on Main Street, the final segment on pesticide safety from Harvest Public Media. Sue Balcom will join us with Main Street Eats, and Ashley and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. There are still a number of jobs available in North Dakota's oil patch. State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms says as activity continues to ramp up, the help wanted signs will be out. Helms says for now, companies are finding enough workers for frac crews.
But on the other side, gas plant technicians, pumpers and switchers and gaugers and all those people, there's over 1,800 job openings and continue to be. And the operators are really struggling to fill those.
Helm says the industry is working with the State Career and Technical Education Department to try to get more students interested in those jobs.
We're actually starting to look at how could we begin to train people as juniors and seniors in high school to collect their high school diploma and have some college credits in this area through CTE or something like that and be able to walk across the stage on Sunday and onto a job site on Monday.
Helm says other states with shale plays have the same problem in finding workers. Morehead city leaders say they are discussing the possibility of selling City Hall. But right now, it's just that, discussion. City Governmental Affairs Director Lisa Bodie says the four-story City Hall in the Morehead Center Mall is outdated and short of space.
Just as Fargo experienced with their City Hall, their previous City Hall that was constructed in the 1960s, Morehead's experiencing growing pains. The building that we're in has substantial, costly maintenance concerns, and there just isn't enough space for the staff that we have. So it is very preliminary.
Bodie says yet to be determined is a sale price for the property. So far, there have been no potential sites mentioned should City Hall be relocated. And the North Dakota Racing Commission will be looking at the potential for expanding horse racing in the state. Right now, the commission sanctions two race meets at Chippewa Downs in Belcourt in June and at the North Dakota Horse Park in Fargo in July. Commission Executive Director Jack Schultz says there has been some interest.
Can we have more tracks in North Dakota? Can we have different types of racing in North Dakota? Do we get involved and help them? Do we make them, you know, that group part of our race weekends? A couple of counties have just inquired about, hey, what if we wanted to do, you know, a weekend at the fairgrounds because we have an old track and, you know, what would it cost to renovate and those types of things. So, and then again, like I said, we're always looking at where do we need to be to make horse racing viable for all of our horse breeders and racers in the state.
Schultz says that will be one of the discussions in a strategic planning effort with the commission and with the horse breeders. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. So far, 10 states have legalized recreational cannabis, giving way to a thriving industry, even though the federal government still outlaws marijuana. In the final part of a series about pesticide use, Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that without federal rules, states are left to come up with their own pesticide regulations for cannabis.
It's unlike any other crop in America. The EPA has done zero testing to determine which pesticides are safe for consumers, and no federally funded programs can teach these farmers how to effectively combat pests. Depending on which state you're in, cannabis growers are largely on their own.
How marijuana growers learn best practices is on the internet, and it's a scary place. It's awful.
Whitney Cranshaw is an entomologist at Colorado State University.
In terms of pest management advice, I have never seen so much gross misinformation, so much junk science, so much silliness.
He often consults commercial farmers on eradicating tricky pests. But because cannabis is still federally illegal, he's not allowed to work with it.
It drives me nuts. And you could make more progress in terms of helping people by providing information on these crops than anything that I've ever worked with.
In Colorado, cannabis farmers have some guidance. Using existing EPA research, state officials have created a list of more than 300 pesticides that they're allowed to use. It's basically a workaround to the gap in federal research because these products are so low in toxins, they can be used on virtually any crop, and they don't leave behind harmful residues. Still, Colorado marijuana growers are caught using pesticides they're not supposed to. Last year, there were 22 cases.
Feels almost tropical in here. That's nice.
It's very humid.
Cynthia Anderson and her husband have run this grow operation in Denver since medical marijuana was legalized almost a decade ago. Inside, it's a wash of bright lights, oscillating fans, and about 450 green marijuana plants. It's small for the industry, but it means Anderson can give each plant individual attention.
Since we look at our plants every day, you know, if she turns a different color, or if she turns yellow, or if she's not getting enough water, or she's getting too much light, that's something that, you know, you pay attention to on a daily basis, and you can do that. Can you do that with 50,000? No.
Pests like spider mites or powdery mildew will decimate a crop of cannabis, which is why growers like Anderson rely on pesticides. But if you're caught using a pesticide that's not approved by the state, officials will take away your products, fine you up to $2,000, and even shut down your business. Anderson says rumors circulate within the industry that not everyone follows the rules.
We hear about the horror stories at other grows and what is done and what isn't done.
Anderson thinks growers might risk using an unapproved pesticide if a pest problem gets out of control and they need something stronger to take care of it.
They don't have any choice but to use that to get rid of whatever it is that their plants have. You're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars of growing plants that are their potential income.
The Department of Agriculture would only share 4 of the 22 misuse cases from last year. The entomologist, Cranshaw, says the unapproved pesticides they listed in those cases are common and not especially harmful. He thinks these growers could have just made a mistake.
There's a massive amount of confusion, and it's quite chaotic, making it very difficult for growers to understand what they're supposed to do.
Growers are still held to the same federal worker protection standards when applying pesticides. But in one case, workers were not given respirators to apply a certain pesticide. In another, a worker reported his employer to the state for pouring pesticides down the storm drain. The department's John Scott says things have only improved since the state started regulating pesticides in the marijuana industry 4 years ago.
I will say that, you know, we've seen a dramatic increase in compliance.
While some states have no regulations in place, Washington, Oregon, and Nevada follow a similar model as Colorado. Illinois, which may pass recreational marijuana this spring, will likely follow a similar one. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
To hear all 3 stories in the pesticide series, visit harvestpublicmedia.org. Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
I am so happy to be here.
Sue Balcom with the Root Cellars Farm outside Mandan joins us once a week to talk about food for Main Street Eats. And this week, you sent some talking points called homemade shrubs or drinking vinegars. And I was immediately confused. I thought you were talking about gardening. Well, not until I got to vinegar, but...
Well,
what is a shrub?
You know, they say there's nothing new under the sun, and I totally believe it. It's kind of like being creative is taking an old idea and turning it over.
Right.
And so if you go into grocery stores nowadays or health food stores, you'll find something on the shelf called a drinking vinegar, which is – they're really delightful. I mean, if you're into drinking a teaspoon of apple cider every day, I would suggest a drinking vinegar. However, I did a little research into making my own, which is kind of a bad habit I have, and I came across this book. I have all of these books on my bookshelf from back in the days, like when Reader's Digest was popular, and it's called Back to Basics. I have all these homesteading books, and in there I found a recipe for what is called a shrub, which is actually a drinking vinegar. The words that were used to describe what people drank back in the day when they had to go out and harvest and work really, really hard in the hot, dry sun are about as old as these recipes, like switchels, shrubs, and syllabubs. Hey, that actually rhymes.
Syllabubs.
And so think about this. They probably didn't drink coffee as much as we do, and they certainly didn't drink soda pop as much as we did because they didn't have it in the grocery stores. And so they had to make them themselves. And so a homemade shrub is actually a fermentation sort of process that involves vinegar, which is the fermented part of it, and sugar and fruit. And they're very, very easy to make. And I've actually made like ginger beer and kombucha and other things like that. And they're very good for, is it slaking your thirst? Is that a word?
Did I use that right?
Slaking.
See, these old words and these young kids are like, you can't use that word. I'm like, look it up.
Look it up.
Actually, I wrote a brochure one time and I said that we were foraging for food. And they're like, you can't use that word. And I'm like, yes, I can, because I learned what it meant because I looked it up. And so you need to look it up too. However, back to shrubs and switchels. I love those. There were nicknames for things like haymaker's punch or ginger water or swizzy. And switchel actually originated in the Caribbean. And, of course, use apple cider vinegar, use a good quality vinegar, water, and then a sweetener, and then a flavoring. And that's where your fruit comes in. And so, like, if you used a cup of cherries, a cup of sugar, a cup of water, and a cup of vinegar, you can create these wonderful drinks that don't have a lot of stuff in that your body doesn't need. And then you can use your fruit meat. You know, don't throw anything away, but, you know, like, let's say you cook your cherries up and you mash the juice out of them. You can use those cherries to put over a piece of cake or mix with your yogurt or something. So it's really dual duty right there if you're out there. Well, rhubarb would be a good example. Rhubarb should be coming up soon, and we'll talk about that at a later date, I'm sure. But rhubarb was something that my mom made a lot of these sorts of drinks out of.
Now, you just mix this stuff up and put it on the counter, or do you heat it up? Or, I mean, it's fermenting. Do you have to make it stop at some point?
Well, you know, if you leave them out on your counter, your apple cider vinegar will continue to ferment, actually form a mother on the top of it, which is kind of the symbiotic bacteria and yeasty stuff that actually make it vinegary.
Uh-huh.
But yes, if you just cook up your water and sugar and add your fruit and then you kind of drain that out and then put the vinegar in, you can drink that just the way it is there. I like to let things sit around on my counter and get fizzy.
Mm.
And that's what happens is things get fizzy, so be careful when you open them up, because one time my ginger beer went like all over the place. And I don't know if you remember, maybe not, but you'd be sitting around the dinner table and all of a sudden, boom. And we're like, oh, one of the pop bottles blew its cap off.
Well, how long is it good?
I think vinegar has a lot of preservation properties in it. So it pretty much until it gets too bitter. You know, vinegar sometimes will continue to eat the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
The mother will continue to eat the sugar out of a concoction like this. So I wouldn't leave it too long. You'll find that they're really tasty. And you can also mix them, like, with liquor for fancy cocktails.
That help you be a little bit less hungover, too, because there's some health benefits to drinking these. You've said sugar a couple of times, and I have a very, very loose understanding of how fermentation works. But, like, the yeast is eating the sugar. Does that mean that ultimately what you're drinking doesn't really have that much sugar in it, or does it just, like, get recycled, I guess, is the yeast like putting that sugar back in just a different form?
Right. It more of the alcohol.
Okay.
More of the alcohol and the fizz comes up. Because, you know, if you've ever made fermented tea, which is kombucha, and I don't even know if I'm saying that right, kombucha?
It
depends on what side of the state you live on. But when you make that, of course, you've got a sweetened tea. Mm-hmm. And then you're introducing the vinegar concept, which is the mother, would be where vinegar comes from. Vinegar is so easy to make. It kind of is it's already built into the fruit, like when you make apple cider vinegar, all it takes is your scrappy apple parts from your pie or whatever you're doing, and it does this itself. But what activates it is that sugar. And so the longer you let it ferment, the more vinegary it will be. So you have to kind of taste it once in a while to make sure that it's not gone bad. But it's never really bad, because you can use it for cooking or cleaning your toilet, because vinegar is an acid.
Yeah, you just go ahead and wash the windows with it.
Right,
yeah.
There you go. And then they would smell fragrant, like cherries or apples or rhubarb.
But aren't
right?
you also making alcohol? I mean, ginger beer is a...
Well, I think that beer back in those days when those recipes were first kind of discovered is a loose term? You know, like root beer?
No, not high alcohol content.
Right, right.
A trace maybe.
Right, just maybe. Well, my husband's convinced when I drink it, I get a little tipsy, but I just debate that.
Is
to
there
no
a difference
end.
Between
just listen to her. Just
regular
listen to her.
Sue and tipsy Sue. No,
can you imagine? No, I don't know. So, you know, the beer is made with yeast and hops and all that kind of good stuff. So I would say that there's a point where it becomes more alcohol than what you would like, but it's not done the way beer is, and so it doesn't have a good taste. That
okay.
You probably want to discard that. But ginger beer, oh my gosh, fresh ginger root is something I
so
absolutely
good.
Love. I love to cook with it. I love to put it in tea. But ginger beer, and I'll put a recipe on my website for ginger beer because that stuff is amazing. But like I said, mine fermented to a point where you had to open every bottle over the sink because half of it would go out in the fizz, and then you could drink the other half. So.
All right. Well, cheers to Sue Balcom and Main Street Eats.
So try some old-fashioned drinking this summer. Yes.
Thanks for joining us, Sue.
Thank you.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota. And proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that's the question we try to answer every Thursday because a big weekend's ahead of us again, and it's time to look at the calendar. Ashley Thornburg and I have some news of stuff to do to share with you.
Starting with tomorrow in Dilworth, Minnesota, at the Talk Music venue, there is going to be a performance of classic and contemporary big band jazz music here. This is a 17-piece jazz band, and they're going to be playing music from jazz greats like Duke Ellington, but they're also going to be featuring people like Sir Paul McCartney. This is 7:30 to 9 p.m. Friday the 17th in Dilworth at the Talk Music venue. Tickets are $15.
The Fargo Theater Classic Film Series gets underway, and tonight's movie is Singin' in the Rain. The 1952 musical starring Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, and Debbie Reynolds. The movie starts at 7:30. The cost is just $5 to see a classic film.
Author Frank Varney is giving a presentation this Saturday in Bismarck at Ferguson Books, the memoirs, and he uses air quotes here, of Civil War general and president Ulysses S. Grant. He claims these are well-written memoirs, but not all that factually accurate, and so he has made it his mission to go and talk about this and what he has discovered in his research. And that, of course, has shaped our understanding of history. So he will be presenting 1 to 3 p.m. in Bismarck at Ferguson Books and More, and it's free.
The Barnes County Historical Society presents Dr. Luis da Vinha. That's this evening at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City. This presentation will deal with the many issues of Dr. da Vinha's recent research agenda, Approaches to Presidential Foreign Policy Making in the 21st Century. Dr. da Vinha is an associate professor of geography and political science at Valley City State University. It starts at 7 this evening, and it's free.
You can learn how to grow microgreens this Friday the 17th in Minot at the extension of NDSU in Ward County. This is a great educational opportunity to grow these little nutritional powerhouses. They're easy. Even I can do it. And you just need a little bit of pointers and you will be well on your way to having great tasting, super nutritious food easily accessible at home. This, again, is in Minot on Friday the 17th at the NDSU Extension office in Ward County, 12:30 to 1 o'clock, and it's free.
Artsy 2019 is Friday in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art on the UND campus. It's showcasing both up-and-coming and distinguished artists. Artsy gives guests the opportunity to view art from a variety of mediums, mingle with local and regional artists, and purchase one-of-a-kind pieces. Guests are encouraged to enjoy appetizers and drinks while surrounding themselves with live music and a unique art experience. It runs from 5 to 8 on Friday at the North Dakota Museum of Art in Grand Forks, and it's free.
And while you're in Grand Forks, stop by the Brick and Barley Bar and Restaurant on Friday the 17th for a beer and cookie dough pairing. Move over, wine and cheese. Uh-huh. Here's beer and cookie dough. 6 to 10 p.m. Tickets are $20. You get an edible cookie dough. Well, aren't all cookie dough samples edible? But you know what I mean. You get cookie dough and then a nice beer sampling to go along with that. 6 to 10, $20 in Grand Forks on Friday at Brick and Barley.
Breakfast at the Zoo is Saturday in Bismarck at Dakota Zoo. It's backed by popular demand. You can enjoy a generous portion of scrambled eggs, pancakes, bacon, sausage, coffee, and juice in a unique place. The zoo animals are more active in the morning, and so it's a great time to visit the zoo and have breakfast. It runs from 8 until 10 in the morning at the Dakota Zoo in Bismarck on Saturday. It's $6 for members, $11 for non-members.
This Sunday, there is a Bio Blitz event, and this is going to be happening at the library in downtown. So a Bio Blitz is this intense period of biological surveying, and what that means is people go out and try to figure out how many species are represented within a certain area. So this Bio Blitz begins with welcome, orientation. You go to walk to one of the urban woods and prairies to document the different birds, plants, insects, and mammals. I bet you're going to be very surprised at how many species call this area home. Starts at 1:30 on Sunday the 19th. The meetup is at the downtown library, and it's free.
There'll be a Heifetz concert Saturday in Jamestown at the Jamestown Arts Center. Classical music is played by the talented string artists of the Heifetz International Music Institute. I suppose that's Yasha Heifetz, sort of his legacy. This program is an opportunity to experience world-class musicians in an intimate setting. It starts at 7 on Saturday evening. Adults, $35. 25 and under, $15 at the Jamestown Arts Center.
All right, my pick of the week is this weekend in Dickinson, Saturday the 18th at the Dickinson Public Library. We heard about this a little bit on our show earlier this week, the Badlands Opera Project's Accessible event. So this performance is not fully staged, but it is an opportunity for audiences, if you're bringing really young kids or adults with different kinds of challenges like ADD and autism, very difficult to take in a lot of great art for these audiences. And so this event is specifically geared towards that. Gets going at 10 a.m. on Saturday the 18th in Dickinson at the library. Tickets are just $10, and people are encouraged to move around and make noise. Hey, maybe I could go to this opera.
Well, it's marathon week in Fargo-Moorhead, and so we've got lots of runners around town and lots of spectators on Saturday. This evening, though, the Fargo Marathon Youth Run takes place at the Fargo Dome. It features distances of a half mile and 1 mile with music, stretches, and warm-ups. It's open to all children 12 and under. Parents and guardians are welcome to run alongside their children or push them in a stroller. And for security, parents and guardians will present a matching race bib when picking up their child. It runs from 5:30 to 9 this evening. It costs $10. Now, the big event is on Saturday. It's the 15th annual Fargo Marathon. It runs through Fargo and Moorhead. It starts at the Fargo Dome and ends there. Thousands of runners and many thousands of cheering spectators will cover the running course. You can go online to find out where to watch and find out how the event will affect traffic as well. The full marathon and relay starts at 7:30 in the morning, but there's a lot more going on. And for full details, go to fargomarathon.com. That's what's happening.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about Thomas Jefferson's only published book, Notes on the State of Virginia.
He didn't intend it to be a published book. He was really just writing an answer to a questionnaire that he had received as the governor of Virginia. But as usual with Jefferson, an infinite capacity for taking pains led to an American classic, Notes on Virginia.
widely considered by most to be the most important American book published before 1800.
And it's a compendium of Jefferson's startling and sometimes radical views on a range of subjects and a couple that are quite controversial.
Yeah, he got himself into a little bit of trouble talking about race issues and religion.
Indeed, but he knew that it was important to express himself. He just didn't know the reaction would be as powerful and negative as it was in some quarters then and now.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 16th. Most towns in North Dakota grew up along the railroad tracks that stretched west across the prairie. In Bottineau's case, it had to move. The village was first established in 1884, but in 1886, when the Great Northern Railroad made plans to lay tracks about a mile to the south, businesses began moving. Interestingly, the new railroad grade helped spare part of the town from a wildfire that swept 500 square miles in the Turtle Mountains area. While some of Bottineau's buildings were lost, the fire mostly claimed the area's fields and haystacks. The railroad brought a boom to Bottineau. The first scheduled train arrived on this date in 1887. The new village was under heavy construction at the time. A large crowd was there to welcome the train and the new station agent. 10 carloads of lumber arrived the next day. More than 100 passengers arrived a few days later. Most of them were homesteaders, real estate agents, or businessmen. Later in the summer, telegraph service was established. And in August, 17 bags of mail arrived by train. It was considered a great convenience at the time, but a few years later, Bottineau Village Council members complained to Washington that mail from Rugby to Bottineau was often delayed by 2 or 3 days. Consequently, private carriers and a stagecoach took over the mail contracts for the next 9 years. However, the railroad could make or break a town. A branch line to Antler was laid in 1905, but when tracks were planned for the town site of Westhope, the village of Richburg was doomed by being bypassed. Few towns in North Dakota have survived without railroad service, but one example, far from Bottineau, is Amadon in the southwest, which likely survived by being the Slope County seat. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, we follow the recovery of a student shot inside her Texas high school 1 year ago.
If it was my time to go to heaven, then it was my time.
Also, we'll hear from pop star Carly Rae Jepsen, who's dedicated herself to an emotional new album.
I was searching for what it was that I wanted to make, and it took me a while.
Hear the news, plus stories you'll talk about all day long on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, it's time for our summer movie preview show. Prairie Public's movie critic Matt Olean and special guests Brittany Goodman and Tony Tilton will join us to talk about the movies that producers hope will lure audiences. And our news director Dave Thompson will offer his analysis of the stories that made headlines this week. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.